Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast about the galaxy's greatest comics, mostly the British ones. I'm Eamon Clark, and it's a warm welcome back for this episode to Johnny Cannon. Johnny, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back, Eamon. It's a pleasure to be here.
No trouble at all. Well, last time, call back to episode 171, Excalibur, talking about the wonders of Alan Davis, who I actually saw at Bedford, who was signing and sketching furiously at Bedford. A couple of weeks ago. But tonight we've got another fantastic British artist that we're going to concentrate on. But before we do that, let's talk about the book itself. What have you chosen for a return visit?
So I've chosen two reprint volumes of Garth, book one, The Cloud of Balthus, and book two, The Women of Galba, which reprint a number of stories which originally appeared in the Daily Mirror during Frank Bellamy's tenure in the strip. So these are from 1971, running into 1972, I believe. So it's a venerable comic strip which ran from 1943 to 1997. So quite a few of your listeners should have heard of it.
So as you say, Titan Collections, the first one from 1984 collects, as you say, a 1 year of basically just about 1 year's worth of stories from the Daily Mirror, all written by Jim Edgar. Mostly it's all Frank Bellamy. I think John Allard, who had been the artist, was doing some backgrounds initially on the first couple of pages. But Frank Bellamy, I gather, was very keen to do his own thing. And he soon takes over the whole thing, doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can see the massive transition in the art when Bellamy takes over completely. I think John Allard was the art director there, and that's why he stayed on for a wee bit to kind of ease the transition. But you see that in other newspaper strips too. Like if someone's coming in to replace another artist, they'll kind of adopt their style for a wee bit and ease that transition, because I guess the newspaper publishers didn't want to spook their readers too much.
The first volume has got an introduction by Nick Landau, of course, of Titan Books. They've both got a sort of Daily Mirror checklist of all of the Garth stories. And the second one has a sort of plot synopsis, an introduction for the Women of Galba story. I'll just mention quickly before we get into it that the second volume has a rather fetching Ian Gibson cover as well.
Yeah, I noted the same thing. It's beautiful, yeah. It really, really is. It looks like he's maybe used an airbrush technique in that as well. It's absolutely stunning.
So, first question, Johnny. Why Garth for the book club?
When I was a kid, I was obsessed with anything presented in a comics format. I was I collected Marvel UK. I dipped in and out a wee bit in 2000 AD. Over the years, I got Battle Action. But I absolutely loved seeing comics in all their forms, whether it was in comic books or comic strips. We used to go round to my gran's house when I was a kid, and my gran used to get the Sunday Post. So I was well used to seeing the Bruins and Oor Willie, and as I used to sit there, rather bored, listening to my gran and papa talk to my mum and dad, I would sit and read Oor Willie over and over again, which was great. My mum was a Daily Express reader, something I'm not, but it was useful when I was growing up, because the Daily Express, for whatever reason, has always had really high quality newspaper strips in them. James Bond is arguably the most famous, but they've also, like, when I was a kid, they reprinted Calvin and Hobbes and Garfield. The Gambles were in there too. My mum, despite being, I'm sure you can guess my mum's politics from the Daily Express, also got the News of the World, which was a bit bizarre because she was quite, I wouldn't say she was particularly liberal. But I used to love that because, don't judge me, George and Lynn was published in that. And the artwork of George and Lynn, that's not why I liked it. Well, that is one reason I liked it as I got older. George and Lynn was drawn by John Burns, and the artwork was absolutely beautiful. And what's quite interesting, you saying off the start about Alan Davis being at Bedford, because we've discussed him before, I actually met him in Enniskillen over summer when we were there and spoke to him at length, which was an amazing experience, and he's a lovely person. He's a massive fan of both John Burns and Frank Bellamy. Sidney Jordan too, right. Who drew Jeff Hawk and Lance McLean. So the things I liked about Jordan, I can't say this seriously now, but the same things Alan Davis did, which is the figure work, it's the gesture. And it's quite interesting when you look at Garth and you look at something like Sidney Jordan's work in Jeff Hawk in particular, and you look at John Byrne's work in numerous newspaper strips, I actually think they're quite similar. They're in a very similar school with regards to the way they, their figure work, a certain angularity in their style, but there's key differences in the way they approach a newspaper strip and key differences in their inking approaches as well. Frank Bellamy's a bit of an outlier when it comes to inking. I'm going to bore you senseless about inking. That's my mission.
You have promised me 8 hours of talk about inking. We'll see.
Aye.
And if you're playing, if anybody's playing the George and Lynn drinking game, it's a very early mention in this episode for the running joke about George and Lynn. Okay. when did you first encounter Frank Bellamy's work?
I would have been very young. My other grandparents, they had a newsagent. In fact, my other gran used to work in my grandma's newsagent for a wee while, and I would look through the newspapers to look at the newspaper strips. The ones I remember most from being a kid, I'm 50, so I remember them from the 1970s, and I do remember Garth, when Judge Dredd was up and running, particularly when it was drawn by Ron Smith. I remember seeing that in the Daily Star and just being like, oh my goodness, that's just unbelievable. And probably the thing that engaged me about Garth is the same thing that engaged me about the Judge Dredd strip, was the quality of the inking. And that's absolutely what's grabbed me later on in life when I've gone back to study things like Terry and the Pirates or Rip Kirby or not so much Flash Gordon. You know, Alex Raymond's work, Milton Caniff's work, because there's specific problem solving when you're drawing a newspaper strip that maybe some people don't realise in relation to a comic book. There's a lot more freedom on when you're drawing a comic book because there's more real estate in the page. And it's getting reproduced at a larger size.
So for anybody who doesn't know, first of all, tell us who Garth is, the character, but also if you could describe the limitations of the format in the newspaper strip.
Okay. So Garth, the best way I would describe Garth is, and this is not the way the news, any formal history of the character would describe it, is it's like Quantum Leap crossed with peak William Shatner, Captain Kirk, except he takes his clothes off all the time and he sleeps with every woman he meets who's stunningly beautiful. That's Garth is whatever he needs to be to progress the story. So he's a mysterious character who's the physique of a Greek god. He's somewhere between 6'4" and 6'8", and he has a strange array of powers, sort of near superhuman strength to some kind of weird sixth sense. He can travel back in time in his dreams or be taken. He ends up going back in time in various different ways, but he also travels out in space too, because occasionally gets kidnapped by beautiful ailing women that he subsequently sleeps with. So it's fantastic. It's a fantastical series. It's kind of sci-fi, espionage, western. The character is whatever the story demands, really. But there is some commonalities across every story he's in that I've alluded to.
And it's in the Daily Mirror newspaper mostly. As you say, it starts there in 1943, created by Steve Dowling and Gordon Boschel, or Boschel. John Allard was 15 years old when he started drawing the strip.
That's not that uncommon. Joe Kubert and Alex Toth, anyone should take a drink when I mention Alex Toth, were both teenagers when they started as well.
And Jim Steve Shooter, Dillon, of course, 16.
Yeah, yeah. Jim Shooter was 13 when he started writing The Legion of Superheroes. So, it's not that uncommon. At that time in the UK, I think it probably would be, because agents would have that agent system would have been in place. And I think newspaper strips were probably a bit of a closed shop. But it's maybe to do with the war, because it was 1943.
Yeah. And I've got it that it ran until 1992. But you said it was 97, you think?
So the date I have is 1997, but then it was right. They recoloured it and started reprinting it in 2011. Colours added by Martin Baines, and that ran until 2019. So one of the resources I used for this was the A to Z of British comic strips. I think there was 165 stories plus a couple of specials in total.
And it's three panels generally.
Yes.
A day in the Daily Mirror, 6 days a week. Mm-hmm. And Frank Bellamy takes over in 1971 and continues until his sad early death in 1976, I think. Mm-hmm. It's an astonishing effort. I mean, both because you pointed out to me before we started recording that not only is he doing these three panels a day every day, mm-hmm. and we'll talk about the amount of ink he puts on the panels in a bit, but he's also doing other work as well. He was doing the Radio Times covers and, you know, things like that at this time as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. It's doable when you kind of take into account that he's so Frank Bellamy differs than say a Milton Caniff, who did everything. He was a cartoonist. He would write, draw, letter. I think he coloured as well in the Sunday strip. And he was doing 6 days a week plus a Sunday strip. But the difference is that Milton Caniff had a studio too, so he would have assistants. As far as I've been able to find out, and Don Lawrence had assistants too, I suppose for a more local example. As far as I know, Frank Bellamy didn't. And from listening to interviews with him and reading interviews with his wife, he took an approach quite similar to Ron Smith, maybe, where it was very much about punching that clock. The way that Frank Bellamy described it was that, you know, the deadline was king, the deadline was his religion, and that's exactly how he phrased it.
Well, before we get to his artwork, you've given us an idea of some of the sort of like genre hopping that Garth does. We're saying that these stories are all written by Jim Edgar, who again has to deliver on the sort of three panels, resolve what happened in yesterday's newspaper, move things on, and then set things up for the sort of the next day, as it were. Just tell us a little bit what you think of Jim's writing and particularly some of the different genres that they managed to cover in these two volumes.
So book one contains four stories. So Sundance, right, tell me when you pick up on a theme here, Eamon, okay? Sundance is where Garth goes back in time to become an American soldier during the Little Bighorn, and he meets a sexy Native American woman. The Cloud of Balthus, he travels into space with a sexy Chinese female spy. The Orb of Trimandius, he travels back in time to meet Leonardo da Vinci with a sexy goddess called Astra. And then the Wolfman of Austin Sea, which I found really interesting, actually, because tonally it stands out to me, actually. There's two stories in these two books that really stand out to me, and this is one of them, which is, to me, it's got a strong Hammer horror vibe to it.
Mm.
He doesn't travel back in time. He doesn't go into space. He ends up fighting a Wolfman who just seems to be deformed. He's cursed, sorry. But he's just, yeah. But he does that with a sexy movie starlet. So I don't know if you've picked up on something there. And then book two, People of the Abyss, it's undersea adventures with a sexy merwoman. The Women of Galba, where he goes into space with a sexy alien woman. Ghost Town, where he goes back in time to meet a sexy dancer in the Lucky Strike Saloon. That was Frank Bellamy's favourite Garth strip, apparently, as well.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, he reprinted that when he died. And The Mask of Atacama, where he goes back in time to the Aztecs with a sexy Aztec princess. So there is a bit of a theme there. very much of its time.
Yes. Well, yeah. We did say that we would perhaps keep a running total of how many times Garth appears topless and how many times his sexy female co-star appears topless. Because,
yeah,
there's a competition between them in a way, isn't there? You know, as well as the male gaze, there's plenty of female gaze here as well, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would argue it's not like George and Lynn, where you know there's a degree of titillation in it.
Mm.
And I don't know if it's just the way that Bellamy draws it in such a functional way. The, after a wee while, you actually start, sort of, you stop noticing all the women are topless. Partly because it's so beautifully drawn, partly the way that Bellamy draws it. It's clunkier in the script, absolutely, because, you know, all women almost fall instantly in love with Garth. But then again, I suppose, if you look like Garth, maybe that would happen all the time, because he is quite the specimen, I suppose is the best way to put it.
He is quite the specimen, as you say. He's like built like a Greek god.
Yes.
He's, you know, as you say, he's somewhere in the mid 6 foot plus range. He, in a sort of James Bond fashion, he often strips down for some sea-related activity, at which point he gets down to the smallest pair of Speedos.
It was more of a thong based on his rather disturbingly well-drawn buttocks. It's quite interesting you saying that, though, because one of the things about Garth that you'll see quite a lot is, you know, the sort of, not the origins in the story, but the origins of the newspaper strip, and that this was meant to be a take-off in Superman, but Steve Dowling also was reading a lot of Terry and the Pirates as well, and that was something he wanted in there too. But when you look at the original drawings, particularly the way Steve Dowling drew them, he actually reminds me of a character called, oh God, I'm gonna get this totally wrong, Stardust the Space Wizard, which was a character created by Fletcher Hanks in 1939, and it ran for, I think, 13 issues in Fantastic Comics. And you might have seen this if you're on Instagram, because there's an artist, contemporary artist called Ryan Heschke, who loves that kind of style of drawing, and there is a very similar, albeit almost grotesque, quality to the way Fletcher Hanks draws Stardust, but really, Garth really, really looks like that in terms of the body mass. Almost like that, it is like, I mean, the character just looks completely blown up in steroids. So it's not Stardust the Space Wizard, it's Stardust the Super Wizard.
Okay, not one I'm familiar with, but we're...
You will absolutely have seen it, I guarantee.
I've seen it, okay.
Yeah, definitely. It's very, very famous imagery. You'll have seen it reprinted in probably Dennis Gifford books over the years.
So I'll also quickly mention the success of the long-running British black and white newspaper strips. You've mentioned some of the big hitters already. James Bond in the Daily Express. Jeff Hawke also in the Daily Express. And I do have the two Titan collections of the Sidney Jordan artwork on Jeff Hawke. You know, so that could come up on the book club in the future. Jane in the Daily Mirror, I'm not sure that was quite so sort of ongoing stories.
No. Modesty Blaze would be one that I would absolutely put alongside Garth and Jeff Hawke. I think, so there's a couple of things probably about newspaper strips it's worth pointing out. And the terminology differs between the US and the UK, because in the US they'll talk about the difference between Bigfoot cartooning and Littlefoot cartooning. And in the UK they talked more about humour strips or gag strips and adult strips. Now, it's not adult necessarily in the sense of George and Lynn. It's more about probably a more naturalistic style of drawing and something which would have been referred to in the US as an adventure strip. And within that, the UK is strange, and Garth is a really, really interesting sort of example of this, where you would get this massive crossover between an adventure strip and a sci-fi strip in the UK. And that's probably because of things like Dan Dare, which were obviously incredibly popular from the original run of The Eagle. And that seeped into newspaper strips with, as you said, Jeff Hawke. There was also Lance McLean, which ran in, I think it was the Daily Record in Scotland, which was that kind of Scottish equivalent of it, that Sidney Jordan was involved in too. So Garth is that weird mix of a kind of Terry and the Pirates, Flash Gordon. It's quite interesting when I was trying to figure out what Frank Bellamy's artistic influences were, and I found an interview where he talked about reading Chips when he was a kid, but didn't read the Dandy or didn't read the Beano. But he did talk about seeing the US Sunday strips, which were reprinted in the UK, and I was trying to find out what those might have been. He did specifically mention Tarzan, and based on his age, that would have been Hal Foster, who went on to draw Prince Valiant, and it probably would have been Byrne Hogarth as well. And you can actually see quite a bit of Byrne Hogarth in the way that Frank Bellamy draws Garth, and you can see quite a bit of Bernhoe Garth in the way Steve Dowland drew Garth as well, because that kind of muscularity, but the way that the kind of, particularly the way Bellamy twists the torso a little bit. Hogarth was quite famous for the way he approached anatomy, which is not necessarily anatomically correct, but it's pretty dynamic. Flash Gordon would have been reprinted as well, and Rip Kirby, which was by Alex Raymond. Alex Raymond also did Flash Gordon. Those were definitely reprinted in the UK. And certainly there's a degree of Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon and Dan Dare, and then from Dan Dare into Garth. That's absolutely there.
Yeah, I mean, it does. Garth can do all the genres. You know, it can cross over, as you say, very sort of Flash Gordon, at times very James Bond, you know, when he's
definitely
his underwater adventures with sexy Chinese super spies. Yeah.
Don't forget the mirror.
And while we're on it, I'll just say that there were also two Titan collections of Modesty Blaise, because you mentioned her. And I don't have those. I'm going to have to track those down, because I've got a feeling that Simon, I'm talking to you now, Simon, might want to cover those at some point on the book club. But anyway, let's get into it then, Johnny. We've got two volumes of Frank Bellamy's artwork. Frank Bellamy, 1917 to 1976. His work on the Eagle, his work on Heros the Spartan, Fraser of Africa, book club episode 229 with Richard Sheaf for more about Bellamy. Here we go, Johnny. I'll turn you loose now. What do you make of his work in these two volumes?
Well, it's a very famous run amongst, I think it's very unfair to call him this, because at the time, I think he would have had a big cultural impact, because this is a guy who was, you know, interviewed a few times in the radio and television, and, you know, shown in television drawing, and was a well-known illustrator. I mean, he wasn't as well-known, say, for example, as Alex Raymond or Milton Caniff were in the States, who generally were superstars. I mean, in the States, when Steve Canyon was launched, Milton Caniff was in the front cover of Time magazine. I mean, those guys were rock stars. But certainly, Frank Bellamy was a very well-respected illustrator. You know, we talked about Radio Times already, and his work in that's absolutely stunning. I absolutely love his work in Garth. I think it's an important run. I think it's probably more important from an artistic point of view than it is from a narrative point of view. I think there's some things in Garth that haven't, I know we've been laughing about it, but there's things that probably haven't dated so well. At the same time, there's some things, you know, particularly around the depiction. Maybe I'm being too sympathetic here, but in Sundance, I was quite surprised at some of the writing around Native American people. You know, it wasn't like, when I was a kid, I'd grown up in the 1970s, you know, I watched a lot of westerns. And, you know, the way that Native Americans were depicted then and what they were called then is not reflected in that strip necessarily. It's much more sympathetic and it's much more balanced. So it's, But and at the same time, it's saying it can be, it's maybe not dated so well. It's women, although they are topless, are not portrayed as, you know, just damsels in distress all of the time, but have agency too, without overstating that. But from an artistic point of view, it's absolutely stunning at times. And I think it's interesting as well, listening to him being interviewed and him saying that, So one of the things he gets asked by an interviewer is, how's your work changed? And he says, oh, it's stayed the same. It's the same approach. But I think it's because he misunderstands the question, because he asks, do you mean materials? And how he talks about working in waterproof inks. And he talks about how, you know, the kind of quality strips stayed the same. But if you look at it, you see this evolution in his artwork through all his strips from, say, King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, through Robin Hood and his Merry Men and Robin Hood and Maid Marian, through to the Churchill strip, through to Dan Dare, through to Heros and Fraser of Africa. And I think probably by the time he gets to Fraser of Africa, it's next level stuff. He's gone from being that kind of quite dyed-in-the-wool, pretty staid British comic artist of the 1950s, you know, quite stiff figure work, something which probably pulls a lot in looking at Hal Foster's Prince Valiant, you know, particularly because the text is underneath the image, although they do use word balloons too. It's quite stiff. By the time he gets to Fraser of Africa, that's when he starts. He did a little bit in Churchill too, but he started using pointillism in his work. So pointillism and stippling sometimes are kind of mixed up. It's not quite the same thing. The main difference is pointillism you do with a brush, you do it with paint, and it's wee dots. So you put lots of wee dots, either quite close together or far apart, to add tone, to a difference in tone to the page. And it's when you're drawing something for comics, less so now because of improvements in printing, improvements in the quality of printing, and because of digital techniques. Traditionally in comics, inking was very, very important because it had to be, rather than, you know, you couldn't reproduce pencils in a newspaper, for example, or in a comic. Although in saying that, some of the comics that Bellamy worked on famously, like Eagle in Boy's Own World, I think it was called, where Fraser of Africa appeared in, were high quality publications. They had really good paper quality, really good colour reproduction in them. You have to ink it. And one of the things you'll see in a comic is a holding line around the figure. So if I'm drawing you, there'll be a black line around your face. That's not how you look in real life. But he dropped that holding line and used pointillism instead. So you see these wee dots. So he dropped the line and he would use colour. You know, it's a painterly approach. And you could do that because of the high quality of the reproduction in those papers. So Fraser of Africa looks stunning. His Dan Dare work looks absolutely stunning too. His Churchill work is not my cup of tea, but, you know, I can see why other people like it. Stippling is a bit different than pointillism because pointillism you use when you're painting, you use different coloured dots. And stippling, you don't. It's just black. It's just wee dots. And how you do that, it's quite funny. I was reading interviews with different artists about Frank Bellamy, and it was one of Frank Hampson's assistants. Oh, gosh, what's his name? Don Harley, I think it is.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Aye. And so he was talking about pointillism and how the you know, everyone really liked his artwork. They were looking at it like, oh, that's amazing. And they said, but just, God, he must be crazy because, like, you know, it takes so long doing that because you're literally battering a pen off a page to do it. He said he must have had a pen like a pneumatic drill. So I've done it in the past when I've been drawing it, and it does take ages. I cheated when I did it. What I did was I had five pigment liners tied an elastic band around them and just battered the page.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It takes an unbelievable amount of time, incredible amount of patience, and it's quite interesting. I'm just trying to find this quote I got when he talks about it. Ah, it was Don Harley. He says, Frank Hampson and all the Dan Dare assistant artists thought highly of Frank Bellamy's drawing in the Eagle magazine in the 1950s. Although we thought his treatment of tone with use of dots was a bit of a joke, stars, and we imagined his pen must have been like a pneumatic drill, we all had to go with drawing dots and found it a bit of a drag, so it didn't catch on with us. That's why you don't see it that much if you're working to a deadline. And Peter Jackson, who's a fellow artist, noted, he was quite willing to share his technique, but there was not, as I might have guessed, any secrets, just sheer brilliance of draftsmanship and years of hard work. The technique was there for all to see. Patience, infinite patience. And Alan Davis talks about that as well, and talks a wee bit about, just going back to Garth specifically, how his work in Garth evolved between 1971 and 1976, where it probably leaned more into what's called chiaroscuro, which is about the balance between black and white. So where you put your shadows. So Frank Bellamy, and you know, I warned you about the inking chat, more than one string to his bow. You know, he could use chiaroscuro, like which is a style that was developed in a strip called Scotchy Smith, which was drawn by Noel Sickles at the time, and then picked up by his friend and studio mate Milton Caniff. So it's quite that noirish look, like you would get. So if you looked at a detective film from the 1940s, that's very close to chiaroscuro in a comic because it's not necessarily grey tones. It's black and white. It's all about the balance, and that's where you can also see that holding line drop to. A good modern example of that is Frank Miller's work in Sin City. That real strong contrast. It's very, very hard to do, and it's beautiful when it works. Doing that in a newspaper strip takes a ridiculous amount of technique, because in stippling in particular takes a ridiculous amount of technique, because you're going from drawing it probably two up and then reproducing it down to quite a tiny size. That's a strip of panels. It's very small. And also newsprint is not good quality. So he used stippling for tone, just to add a bit of... it's interesting seeing how he uses it. He uses it for form. So I know how hard you would have been staring at those women's bodies. You'll notice that he uses, on the curves in a woman, he uses stippling to show the form of the shape. He doesn't do it as much in Garth, which is quite interesting. So that's a big difference between him and John Burns and Jim Holdaway. John Burns in particular was amazing at drawing women in particular. Absolutely incredible. And you can see in Alan Davis's work, you know, the influence of John Burns on the way he draws women, particularly women's bums. But there's similarities between them in terms of their pen line, you know, using a crow quill. Bellamy's, I think he's better with a brush. What's interesting between Holdaway, Bellamy, and Burns is they were all painters too. They were all what you would call illustrators as much as comic artists, you know. And you can see that with the amount of work he did for the Radio Times, which is just a ridiculously high quality. The other thing he did, you thought it was finished with ink and shit, didn't you? The other thing he did, which is really, really interesting, and I have never seen it anywhere else. I don't know if you noticed this. He does this weird thing. You see, they mention this in the Art of Frank Bellamy Illustrators Special Edition. He does this weird, I call it glass wool. It's wiry noodling. So it's just nonsensical lines for shadow.
Mm.
And it's just really, really straight. But it does it in faces. And so I've tried to do that, and it's very hard to do, because if you get it wrong, it looks like everyone's covered in hair. It's just these weird knots of lines. Now, normally, I call it wiry noodling as well, because noodling's just where you're drawing something quite big. And you know when it's getting reproduced smaller, it doesn't matter what you're doing, you're just noodling, you're just drawing wee lines. So for something like cornicing, you would get in a ceiling. Noodling's perfect for that, or for detail in a Victorian building, it's perfect. You're not drawing any, you're just noodling it, because you get a particular type of line with a crow quill pen, which is like a calligraphy pen. You get a very, very thin line. I've never seen anyone else do that. I have seen other people do stippling. David Lloyd's work in V for Vendetta, he uses stippling in that. That's a really good example of it. And I think there's a lot of Frank Bellamy and David Lloyd, an awful lot. And to the point, actually, there's some pages drawn by Frank Bellamy, I'd be like, oh my goodness, that's a David Lloyd. But because I can really, really see that. Just as I can see a lot of Frank Bellamy and Alan Davis too. Not so much, Brian Bolland. I think there's probably more of a Reg Bunn in him, as well as American comic artists too, but it's the inking. So do you want another 6 to 7 hours of inking chat? You see, I mean, it's remarkable, because you pick up, when people talk about influences, I think sometimes it's too easy to look at the style rather than the substance, and also the approach that sits behind that, like the way people think about comics. There's some... I write and draw one comics too, and there's people that I can see. If someone says to me, oh, you draw like that person, I can see it. And other times people are like, oh, you must have been influenced by this person. And no, you're not influenced by them. You like their work, but you're not influenced by them. And then there's people where you specifically take something they do as a tool and apply it in your work, which is exactly the same as someone teaching you how to use a particular thing in Photoshop. They are not an influence in terms of how you think about comics or how you approach comics, your storytelling, which is a really important bit. It's specifically about draftsmanship, like how you draw a car. I'll give you an example of that. Sean Phillips, I remember reading somewhere in an interview, and they were talking about backgrounds in cars, and he said that when he draws cars, he hates drawing them. He always draws the underside of the car in shadow and drops the wheels into that shadow. So the wheels and underside of the car are kind of one thing. And I noticed that because I hate drawing the wheels in a car. I said, that's such a good cheat. I'm going to do that. The only thing is then, if you're drawing the car in motion, you can't do that.
Right.
Because the way you draw a car in motion in a comic strip, if you really want to make it dynamic, you take the car off the ground to show it in motion, which doesn't really happen. Well, it happens in the A-Team.
The Dukes of Hazzard.
The Dukes of Hazzard, aye. Not in Miami Vice or Magnum P.I., I hasten to add. That undershot, every time, that poor cameraman lying back underneath the 18 van.
And
the General Lee. So there's a lot to learn from studying Frank Bellamy. His figure work is phenomenal. I think his work really moves. I think the combination of Jim Edgar and Frank Bellamy, I was quite struck. I don't know how you felt about it. When I was reading through this, sometimes when you're reading reproductions of, when I'm reading through reprints of newspaper strips, you'd said earlier on about how you've got three panels, sometimes four panels, and you're kind of catching up on what happened the day before, and you've got to have a cliffhanger. You do it in three panels. This strip didn't feel like that at all. I was very, very surprised, actually. It rattles along. To me, you know, you really feel that you are on a, you know, roller coaster, and you're going right to the end of the line. It zips along. Sometimes newspaper strips, when you read them as a collection, which are not designed to do, you know, they're meant to keep you in the hook and go back every day, keep buying the newspaper, not necessarily designed to be read in the trade. Is it where it could be quite clunky, quite turgid? This didn't feel like that to me. At all. There was a couple of stories that I wasn't quite as engaged with, but things like Ghost Town to me and The Wolfman of Austin Sea, I was actually really surprised. I actually forgot I was reading a newspaper strip because it worked so well. And maybe that's, I don't think it's to do with something that was one of Frank Bellamy's strong points about comic books, which was to break away from the formalism of the grid. So you know that 9-panel, 6-panel, 4-panel grid. He started doing, you know, the jagged angle panels, circular panels, and he said that was because he was bored with frame after frame of squared off panels. He wanted something more dynamic. And the best example, I think he started doing it in Heroes of Spartan, and it's absolutely there in Thunderbirds. I was saying to you just before we come on, I think maybe he goes a bit too far in Thunderbirds. Sometimes the storytelling is a wee bit unclear because you're not quite sure which panel follows on, particularly because of the kind of landscape format, the double page spread. But he wanted to view not just the panel as a unit, but the page as a unit. And again, there's a similarity in what I do as well, when I'd stopped looking at, you know, people sometimes ask, how do you do it in terms of, you know, is the panel the picture or is the panel the painting? It's like, no, it's the panel, it's also the page. And what's really interesting was when you were my editor on DUI and I did a double page spread, you said, just remember the, you know, the art doesn't get swallowed up with the page turn in the middle of the piece. And I was, because it wasn't saddle stitch, it was true bound. And I was like, yeah, no, I factored that into my margins. Those are the type of things that you have to really think about, and that's where I think he was particularly strong, was he wasn't just thinking about the panel, he was thinking about the product, and it's there in his colouring, it's there in his inking. He was, you know, an illustrator as well as a comic artist. He really knew about the product, he really knew about the printing limitations and the challenges of doing a newspaper strip, and I think that's why it's so good. He just really understood what he was doing, and he wasn't just good at drawing. So for me, Garth is, I mean, it is cheesecakey at times. It's just a masterclass in how to cartoon in terms of pacing, in terms of drawing. It's actually remarkable. It really is.
Astonishing stuff. And I've now got a name for it, the wild wool noodlings, which I now think of a sort of characteristic of Frank Bellamy. And as you say, how he uses it to show light and shadow. So one side of a face or a figure will have this noodling on it, which, as you say, in a way shouldn't work because it looks... I'm looking at Garth's face from the Cloud of Balthus, mm-hmm. where half of his face is in either in shadow or in the wild wool noodlings. Mm-hmm. And you might think, oh, he's got some terrible disease on that side of his face. But no, it's just like he's got this wonderful definition. And it gives this great depth to the panels
completely,
as well.
Completely. It's funny earlier on, you mentioned a few times about the underwater scenes.
Yeah.
That is so hard to do. And when you... one of the things about drawing is when people talk about staying on model, it's always making sure that your characters, look consistent through a comic, and that's something that's difficult, particularly if you're doing small press comics in the long form, because you do over such a long period of time, your art style changes. What people don't talk about so much is maintaining that consistency in your style with regards to background, shading, and so on. And again, these two, I'm just trying to think actually the run. I think it is two years worth of strips. It's a year for each book. It stays remarkably consistent. It's technique is really, and it's and I suppose it is a natural evolution. It's minus the colour that it had on Heroes and Thunderbirds. He certainly was using that wiry noodling on Heroes. On the helmets and stuff like that. There's a million different ways you can do... Well, not a million. There's a few different ways you can do metal, that shine. But underwater is really hard to do. Really hard to do. And he does it in quite an impressionistic way. Like someone like Hugo Pratt does it with like quite abstract shapes of black, which again just works as well because it's all about the contrast. It's all about the balance between black and white, how you do it. There's one thing that he didn't do. And it's interesting that he used stippling rather than Bendy or Zippitone, which American strips did. There's a cartoonist who's, again, probably not a lot of people have heard of, called Roy Crane, who was massively influential at the time. He did Buzz Sawyer and Wash Tubbs. And he was an incredible cartoonist. He's one of my favourite cartoonists. If you can get hold of the Buzz Sawyer strips, I cannot recommend them enough. They're wonderful adventure strips, really, really masterclass again. But he's probably the best person ever. I mean, to use Zippitone or Bendy, which is the wee mechanical dots, I suppose, was used in some British strips. Jim Holdaway used it in Romeo Brown, which he did before Modesty Blaze, but he stopped doing it. I'm not too sure why Bellamy didn't do that. It might have been because of his fine art. Because he was really into fine art as much as comics, and I think probably perceived himself to be a fine artist as much as an illustrator. It might have been that, or it might have just been that didn't particularly reproduce well in newspapers, or it might just have been because he was using it pointillism in his painterly when he was painting stuff. When he was using coloured inks and Heroes. And Churchill and Thunderbirds, he was just so fast at doing it. It was muscle memory. Because it is it's ridiculous. You're battering the page with a pen or a brush. So maybe that's why he didn't use Zippitone or Bendy. Or maybe it wasn't that available here.
I don't know what size the original... I know there are some of these pages are up on Comic Art Fans, but I don't know what size the originals are. I presume they're quite large, are they, compared to these... newspaper
there's some
strips.
Actual size in the Illustrator's special edition on them, and you'll see it in there, it's pretty big.
Right.
When I've done newspaper strip style things, I'll do it on an A3 bit of Bristol board, which is what I draw on normally, and I'll do three strips on that, but I've seen them go bigger, so it's pretty big. When you look in that, it's kind of a panel, I think. I could be completely wrong, but I need to take this in actually when I'm really looking at it. I think it's about kind of it's almost a square size, maybe B5. So it's quite
right.
Big. And when you look at the wiry noodling, it just looks so insane at that size. You're like, that can't possibly work. But then in the stippling too, it's very easy to get lost in those dots because you're doing it so much bigger, because you're thinking about how it's going to... You have to be so experienced to know it's going to look right when it's reproduced, particularly on a different paper type as well, because the paper he would have been working on would have been, you know, pretty pristine white. You know, newsprint's not, particularly not back then. Remember when you used to read 2000 AD or... You'd pick up the newspaper and then your hands would just be black.
It come off on your fingers,
aye.
Yes.
And you'd rub your face and you'd have big finger marks all over your face as well. It was, you'd tell who was picking their nose.
The joys of newsprint,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's utterly fantastic. I think, you know, I guess this is the longest run of Frank Bellamy I've ever read. And it's, you know, it's masterful. And as you say, you can see all those great mm-hmm. artists who use black and white. Mm-hmm. The ones that you've mentioned who went before him, but particularly the ones who've come since him and learned from him. It's just wonderful. And, of course, with Garth, the character, you can tell pretty much any story with Garth in a way. He's a sort of, as you say, he's a quantum leap character who can just stick him in any type of story.
Yeah. Any type of story, so long as there's a topless woman.
And so long as there's a space babe, preferably, or you know, or a super spy, yes.
Yeah, or merwoman, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Sexy saloon bar dancer as well, yeah.
But, I mean, it's quite funny, actually, because I was really thinking about this, and when I was doing a wee bit of research around Garth, and they talk about his supporting cast, out his first couple of years on Garth, and I've not read... the rest of it, although in Down the Tubes there's a fantastic resource on Garth where they do actually reproduce quite a few of the strips as drawn by different artists, because the person that drew Garth for the longest was Martin Asprey, and he's right. Really, really good. And then Steve Dowling's stuff, which is a wee bit stiff and it's a bit of its time, but it's still good. It's interesting, and then have we look at it. I'd like to look a bit more at Bellamy's later work, because the thing Davis said about that was the later period of Frank Bellamy's tenure in the Garth newspaper strip is often given less regard than the earlier, more detailed work, but I find this work most exciting. The style, bolder and streamlined to survive the poor quality of printing and paper, still contains all of the strengths of the artist's earlier work. And he talks about how the line work and creases maintain a superficial reality, but also suggests movement as well as form, while elegantly avoiding the cartoon extremes of other artists. But one thing he actually puts in as well is that he also makes a point about the dramatic perspective of the balloon tales, and that's something to note about Bellamy as well. He was doing the lettering usually in all his work too. So I think a strong point of Frank Bellamy was his graphic design. I think that's something that makes the best comic artist stand out. And I think that's something that's absolutely been lost with digital lettering. You can sometimes see onomatopoeia. You know, it's not drawn. It's layered on top digitally. And if it's stock effects, it looks not the best at times, because it's not consistent to the art style. It's not integrated into the art. So there's a recent example of someone who's, you know, good at integrating sound effects or sound effect, onomatopoeia into the art is Frank Quitely, what he did.
Yes.
The best examples of it are, you can take another drink, Alex Toth, with onomatopoeia, but also Will Eisner, his approach to graphic design, particularly regards to titles, and that's something that Alan Davis, you know, loved about Frank Bellamy was, you know, the title strips for Garth. I mean, they are stunning, whether it's, you know, one or more images and he's drawing the titles and integrating it in a very stylized way into the art. Those are absolutely stunning. And that's something I thought about when I was like, oh, he's going to ask me about Grail strips. Which would he pick? And I was very tempted to pick those titles because he's a wonderful designer too. I mean, you see it in the way that he laid out the page as a unit and stuff. It's just, but that should all be in service to the storytelling. And that's why with Thunderbirds, I think, he maybe veered a bit too much into the graphic design side of it, because I don't think it was in service to the story, the art. I think it was about the, God, that design looks amazing. It's just, there's a very, very, it's sometimes difficult to get that balance, particularly if that's the thing that people want from you, that kind of, you know, super crazy layouts. There's a time and a place to use it. And if you're doing it all the time, it's a bit like the, for football fans, the Alex Ferguson hairdryer. If someone's screaming in your face all the time, you stop listening. It's the same with you know, really overtly wild layouts. You know, there's a particular rhythm for comic books. In newspaper strips, an advantage of the stricter formalism of it is you don't really have that problem. You know, you've got that 1, 2, 3 or 1, 2, 3, 4 or 1, 2 if it's a titles strip.
Brilliant stuff. Well, I will mention that these are two Titan volumes from 1984, 1985, I think. They're hanging in there, mine, not showing the binding problems that we associate with Titan. Beautiful reproduction. They obviously, Titan at the time, were doing some of the classic news strips because there, as you say, two volumes of Jeff Hawk, two volumes of Modesty Blaze. These two volumes, I picked them up on eBay. I think I paid £20 or £30 for each volume. Cause,
really?
Yeah.
I got them both for a tenner. Minor payment. I'm so sorry for suggesting this.
No, that's all right. It's quite all right. I'm glad to have them.
Aye.
Before I ask you about a Grail image or two, any particular favourite stories, either for the story or for the art, or for both?
In these two, I would say the Wolfman of Austin Sea. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that correctly. I'm butchering that. In Ghost Town, you can see the influence of. You can tell that. So one thing that the reason why Bellamy liked Ghost Town so much was because he loved westerns. And one thing, so again, another thing that's always interesting about comic artists, I think, to separate the really good comic artists and the really good writers, is that they don't just stick to them. They don't just learn from that one medium. They don't just learn from comics. They learn from, you know, other forms of writing, whether it's plays, TV, movies, prose. And I think sometimes that can get frustrating, particularly in modern comics, where you can tell someone's written something as a TV pitch or as a script for a film, and it's not happened. It just doesn't apply to comics because it's a different medium. You know, it's a different form to it. So, but he was an avid cinema buff. That was something that came out in the interview with his wife, which was in Speakeasy issue 100, which I think was 1989, and it's reproduced in the frankbellamy.com website. And it's really interesting. And he liked westerns because, again, you know, he was able to study it and draw it. And it's possibly because I've just recently rewatched the Dollars trilogy. I can see quite a bit of,
right,
you know, Sergio Leone in there. And what's interesting was the last thing he was working on when he died was he was doing, I think it was some storyboards and concept design work for Sergio Leone.
Oh, blimey, okay.
So there is a wee bit of the spaghetti western in Ghost Town. I don't know what it is. It must be something to do with the angles he's using.
Yeah.
So another thing, I know I'm banging on about this, another particularly difficult thing to do in a newspaper strip is when you establish a scene in a comic, you typically do an establishing shot and then you will use a mix of medium and close-up shots to show the action depending on what it is. And then you make them out to a long shot. And you can do that from different angles. You know, if it's a conversation, you know, some people say, like Gabriel Hardman, for example, will say, you shouldn't move the camera around too much because it's too distracting for the reader. You should position it on the shoulder of the person who's getting, you know, who's the passive person in the conversation at the time, and show the face of that person. Or you can show it side to side, or you can show overhead, or you can move about. I like quite like moving about. Doing an establishing shot in a newspaper strip is quite challenging. And because one of the things in a newspaper strip is the importance of cropping. You know, what you show, what you don't show. And you see that quite a bit in any scenes in here he does with, like, for example, when Garth's in his rather cool sports car. You know, it's difficult to fit the whole car into the panel. So you're drawing parts of things and also making it very clear what's happening. It's, if you're drawing, and I'm not joking when I say this, lots of topless women in The Women of Galba, or the two main two female characters in, oh my gosh, I forgot the name of it, The Mask of Alakama.
Yeah.
Get differentiating them at that small size, particularly when they both get black hair, is not easy to do, and he does it. Because you don't have colour to do it. There is that thing, people used to joke about Silver Age Justice League was, you could tell who was talking by the colour of their hair and their,
right,
the colour of their costumes. Because it, you know, it's the same figures, same haircuts, you know. You look at an old Avengers comic, you know, drawn by Don Heck or John Buscema, who I love both their work. And if Clint Barton and Steve Rogers are out of costume, you know, with Hawkeye and Captain America, you're not telling them apart.
No.
But he manages it, and it's that's impressive, really impressive. So I would say those two stories, but I liked them all. I was so excited reading this. I was just, oh my goodness, this is way better than I remember. Because again, I was only really kind of dipping in and out of it when I, you know, saw it somewhere. My mum and dad didn't get the Daily Mirror. They got the News of the World. What a strange combination. There was another comic in there as well, because he used to do a photo comic in the News of the World, and I'll see if you pretend to not know what I'm talking about, which was the problem page, and it was a photo version of George and Lynn, which was too much for me when I was a young kid. So what is going on with this?
Was that all about cheating boyfriends and cheating girlfriends?
Yes, it was. And it's amazing how many plumber's wives wrote into the happy hand column. Dear Deirdre, whatever it was called.
There was an awful lot of dodgy waterworks and plumbing problems in those days.
those boilers are constantly breaking down.
If you want a masterclass in his wiry noodling, Ghost Town is the one, isn't it?
Yeah.
The textures, the depth, the light and dark, and his wiry noodling. Wonderful stuff. I love those two stories. I love the Wolfman story because, you know, it's classic sort of Hammer horror.
Yeah.
Somewhere in, and you know, middle Europe that's not really completely spelled out. But yes, wonderful. They have literally got a wolfman locked up in the attic.
It's quite a lot of pathos in that story.
Yeah.
I was quite surprised by it. I was like, oh, I actually feel quite, yeah. In saying that, the Cloud of Balthus, the underwater scenes you mentioned, absolutely stunning. Really, really stunning.
And shout out for Sundance, which, as you say, has this sensitive approach to the Native Americans and probably quite rightly makes the 7th Cavalry the bad guys.
And it's that artwork and that, once it gets into full Bellum and he kind of breaks free of the constraints, it's incredible too. He's not quite, there's almost a, when I say about that, angularity, at times Frank Bellum's working Garth, it almost but not quite, I think it's better, reminds me of Carmen Infantino when he was doing his Flash work, you know, that I don't know if it's just because they're drawing it with such motion that kind of lends that angularity, the way that drawing someone like Garth with that exaggerated physique is not easy to show in motion. Because it's not like the Hulk, that's basically a square shape. You know, with thick, you know, the thick waist. Like Garth is that kind of, you know, that ridiculous. Michelangelo's
thin waist.
Steroids was one of the best descriptions I read of it. I mean, it's not easy to do.
No. Okay. What about the impossible challenge of giving you a few either strips or a page from this collection or these two collections to have as grails? Have you got any?
Yes. So I've narrowed it down to I can narrow it down to one if you really want. So in page 28 of Garth book 1, in the Cloud of Balthus, There is, on the second tier, on page 28, there's a two-panel strip, and it's Garth swimming underwater in scuba gear. In the first panel, he's cutting his knee on a bit of reef, and in the second panel, a shark appears. And there's, he's just, it's just a masterclass. It's just,
yeah.
The chiaroscuro and, oh gosh, the stippling. There's not any wiry noodling on it. It's just stunning, but he drops the holding line. It's fantastic. And that second panel is reproduced in Modern Masters Volume 1, Alan Davis, which is another reason why I get, because, you know, I wanted to pick Garth was because I was going back through Modern Masters, cause I haven't met Alan Davis in summer, and that being a just really a, no, I wouldn't say life changes the wrong way, just an incredible experience. You know, just when you meet one of your heroes and it turns out they're a lovely person and they're funny, and they actually say to you, do you want to just sit next to me and speak to me for a while? Because I like speaking to you, and you're just there for 2 hours. It's just like talking about inking, just ranting at him about inking. I wasn't really. Yeah, I was listening most of the time, watching draw. But look, that strip for me is unbelievable. So if you buy that for Matt Christmas, that's fantastic. Thanks, Eamon.
I'll buy that for Christmas virtually. Yes, okay.
And on page 92 of book one, the bottom tier is, so this is The Wolfman of Austin Sea, or Austin Sea, it probably sounds better.
Mm-hmm. Oh, look at that, yeah.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, it's honestly, that is so hard to do. Because, I mean, keeping that decipherable, you know, at that size, it's just unbelievable. So there's a trick in what he's done, because the first panel in particular, he's got people wearing black suits. So the suits have lighting on them to show the creases and to show the folds, to show the drapery. And then round it, what you would do to show that contrast is you would do an area of white around the figures. But he's stippled it too. And then he's got the dog. And then he's got the trees. And he's got his line work. It's ridiculous. I mean, it really is. Another thing is in that second and third panel as well, you're going in for close-ups. And again, the lighting in the faces is absolutely fantastic. The mood in these pages is incredible. You know, it's really foreboding. And his position of his lettering, because he's gone for that, I mean, I would pretty much call it a money shot in that first panel. It's probably, you know, it's almost like a long panel. He's taken up a lot of space in that establishing shot. So he's not got much room for his lettering in the second panel. And his placement's excellent. Really, really good. Because he avoids any tangents on the balloon tail. So that's a tangent where you've got two lines that kind of overlap. And so it kind of, with balloon tails, it means it can disappear into the line art. So it makes it harder to read. Can I do one more, please?
Of course. Yeah, go for it.
It is in book two, and it's People of the Abyss. The only thing I'll say about People of the Abyss, the design of the monsters is so disturbing. It really was terrifying. It's like the worst Doctor Who villain ever, just those octopi squid creatures, both squids.
The Homods.
So anyway, page 25, the third tier down, and it's not because of the topless shot of Garth or the woman. It's that again, that establishing shot, the lighting, the shading, it's just the way he does water, the way he does the sky, the second panel, the way that he drops a holding line with the narration box. It's just the graphic design is just unbelievable. He drops the panel borders for the final panel to really give it a sense of dynamism. And that's an example where you see that graphic design add flair, motion, and drama to a newspaper strip. It's fantastic. You see him pull that trick quite a bit, and you saw that in Heroes, but particularly Thunderbirds, where, for example, you would have figures breaking out the panel borders. you know, you can't do that all the time. You do that kind of thing sparingly, because it's about, you know, that's the keynote in the story. That's how you punctuate the beat. So that's £8 million. Thank you again. Right. Very generous. The first one would be the main one, though, for me.
Okay. Well, I'll just take us back to page 18 in book two, which is also from People of the Abyss. And the third tier is Garth fighting one of those giant octopus creatures, the Homads, and throwing one of them towards a glowing ball, which explodes in black and white. And it's just... I love a black and white explosion.
That was one of his favourite things to draw. His wife said he loved drawing explosions.
Right.
That was... you can see the wiry noodling there in his back, and just the lighting adding to the form. That's absolutely stunning.
Yeah, great stuff, Johnny. Well, it's been fantastic talking about one of the key newspaper strips from British newspapers, and of course, key British artists. Mm-hmm. Frank Bellamy obviously deserves more than just one episode about him. So, mm-hmm. great stuff. Mm-hmm. Thank you for picking them. So, guest projects time. Tell us what's been happening with Cannon Hill Comics and your own work, and some shading and stippling and inking techniques.
It takes so long, honestly. I do not have the patience for it at all. I like to mix up. You can see my video. My wife gave me a... So I've got a pencil case, which is filled with inking tools. I use whatever. But my wife gave me a big... old makeup box, and that's absolutely filled with stuff as well. So I'll link with razors sometimes, which Alberto Breccia did, and things, and brush pens and crow quills and brushes and sponges and charcoal, and it's fantastic. That's one of the best things about doing your own, you know, doing small press comics, is you can just really experiment with it, and you know, your audience is so small. Doesn't really matter, because you know a newspaper's not relying on you to sell millions of copies, or in current circulation, tens of thousands of copies. So the thing I'm doing just now is I'm working on a new book, which I'm hoping to get out next year, called Five Triangles, which is, well, its full title is The United Five Triangles. So it's in the United series.
Oh, right, okay.
So I'm doing that, and I am about 53 pages into that, which is good. Our mutual friend Tony likes to ask me how long the book's going to be, because he'd once asked me, how long's this comic? And he's like, 7 pages. And then in the end, it was 220 pages. Carried away there. It's the danger of being a cartoonist, I suppose, when you write your own stuff. So I'm looking to get out next year, and that's going really well. The way that I draw that or structure those comics is, because it's funny, I was always much more into American comics, but I loved like Battle. I get into 2000 AD, and I love that kind of 3, 5, 7, 11 page installments. And I think if you're doing your own comics, it's much easier doing that, because you know you're making elephant burgers, you know. So if you've got a 200 page comic, if you've done 10 parts of it, it's way less intimidating. But also it's easier to write as well. I don't really write, I have a structure in my head, but I don't write out scripts. But it's much easier for pacing, because it's almost like the way I approach it is almost like a Seinfeld episode, where you've got Elaine, George, Jerry and Kramer, and each one's got their arc, their beginning, middle and an end. And over 7 page installments, it's just much easier to pace those arcs and push it forward. That's the thing, again, going back to Garth, that amazed me, was they were able to, I mean, there's no supporting cast. There's Professor Lemure, who's barely in it. He's just psychoanalyzed. What does your dream mean? Why were you back in time? But it's much easier to do that, particularly if you've got a large cast, which my comics do. I like having a lot of characters, because, you know, it's fun when they're having conversations between each other, and you know, because it's comics, if they're fighting each other, it's good having that large cast. But, and again, one of the benefits of doing my own comics or anyone else who does their own comics is there's more, I suppose, there's higher stakes. Because you know in a James Bond film or a Spider-Man comic, well, actually, it's not true in a Spider-Man comic. You know in a Spider-Man comic he's going to die every other issue, but we brought back the issue afterwards.
Yeah.
So, but that's not the case when you're doing your own stuff. I like making comics where the reader hopefully doesn't know what's going to happen when they turn the page. I like doing comics where you build up that sense of dread. I really like David Lynch films, and I like elements of Hitchcock films too. I like how you do suspense in comics and dread in comics, because I don't think it's easy to do in comics. So I am working on that just now, and it's going pretty well. I'm actually quite happy with it, and I feel that I've been doing it long enough now that I don't hate to draw. But I can also see the room for improvement as well. There could be nothing worse than being like a Frank Bellamy, where you reach that top, the top of the mountain. You've plateaued. You know, I mean, he get better in very, very small stages. You know, once he got onto Heroes of Spartan, because it's just ridiculous at that point.
Yeah.
But if I'm not Frank Bellamy, so I've got massive space for getting better, and that's exciting too, and frustrating. So I'm working on that just now.
So we can find your comics at cannonhillcomics.bigcartel.com.
Yes, and I'm on Instagram as well.
You're on Instagram, right? Okay. So
yes, under Cannon Hill.
I'll put your Instagram and your Big Cartel store in the show notes for this episode and on the website. Are you still on Twitter, or have you? No,
I came off.
Good.
I came off X. Oh gosh, 2 years ago maybe? No, maybe a year ago.
Okay, yeah.
And I came off Facebook as well. I came off Facebook because I was getting so much spam mail after my Kickstarter, because I did some, I used Meta advertising, and it was every day, it was like 10 emails accusing me of stealing someone's intellectual property. Clicking this link to was honestly, what on earth? And just after a while, I was like, or people offered to run my Kickstarter campaigns too. It was just unbearable. So I came off Facebook. Social media is really difficult now. It's very difficult to... I know that marketing is really important, particularly if you're a small press cartoonist, but it's next to impossible doing it in social media now.
Mm.
It's really, really difficult. I think I am in Blue Sky as well.
Oh, nice.
I'm in Threads.
Yeah.
But all I do in Threads is, I don't know, would you call it, re-quote or quote someone?
Yeah, reposts, yeah.
I repost Peanuts cartoons. Yeah. I love Peanuts. And also comics historians, whatever they put up, because it's so, they're brilliant for their newspaper coverage and understanding superhero comic books by Alex Grant. It's worth getting, actually. It's really good. So... That's my only social. It's amazing I don't sell a million copies when I'm practically invisible online, isn't it? No one's heard of me.
Well, I'll try and post links to the social platforms that you do use for the show notes for this episode. You were in DUI issue 2.
Yes.
With your daughter, if I remember rightly. Was that right?
That's right. Yeah, my daughter was very young at the time, and she was very moved that you mentioned her when you were on ACP, and she went into school and told all her friends, rather embarrassingly, that I'm famous and that she's famous too now. And then my son fell out with me because I didn't do a comic with him.
Oh, no.
And also because the name of the monster, and that's called a Kankenbod. He made that up when he was a wee boy, the word Kankenbod. And I should have, I'm Stan Lee, I've stolen credit from my own son.
Oh no, oh no.
Attributed to my daughter though in this case. He used to say these words when he was a wee toddler. He would say, "You're a piscus." "He's a piscus." And then, "That's a Kankenbod." And he was just, oh, he was so cute. But now he's 10 and he's the same height as his mum. He's ridiculously, he's shredded as well because he's so vain. But he still does. "Dad, can we do a comic together?" I was like, "Well, why don't you draw one?" But my daughter, yeah, she helped with the story and that. She draws quite a lot now. So I really do like the idea of, she is, I've never learned to paint. And she's going to art classes. I'd quite like to paint one of my comics. Although she has nine, so I've been off for a few years. Like, spent 2 days drawing that, and that's what you've done with. But aye. No, I was brilliant. I really liked doing that. I really enjoyed that. And you were a terrifying but supportive editor.
Well,
Where's your pages, Johnny? Where's your pages?
Where's my pages and my pictures of Spider-Man? You can find all his 3 issues of DUI free to read on the Global Comics app. And I've still got some copies of issues 2 and 3. And if people contact me, I'll probably just send them to you.
can I promote that as well? So I have some copies of DUI as well, issue 2. And I will be at ECAF on November 27th in Edinburgh, and I will be selling copies of DUI.
All right. So about a month after this
episode. Charity as well.
So. A month after this episode comes out. So hit Johnny up there for copies. And I'll just mention there's a probably considerable crossover between the audience of this podcast and Tony Esmond's Never Iron Anything podcast. You were last on the Never Iron Anything, I think about a year ago, doing a sort of review of 2023 with Tony.
He's banned me. I'm convinced of it now. I keep saying, it's funny. I don't know if you do this with Tony. I subtly suggest me going on Never Iron Anything by just buying him a comic and sending him it. And I sent him I love the Silver Age Doom Patrol run because it's just so crazy. It's the most Marvel comic ever produced, and it's not actually published by Marvel. It's just insane. And Arnold Drake and Bruno Premiani are really interesting people too, with really interesting personal histories. And he lost the comic. And every time I see him, I say, what's happening to this Doom Patrol thing? He avoids talking about it to me, which makes me talk about it even more. So, yeah, no, this podcast and that one, I really like going on. It's really, really, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Johnny. Well, I'll say that the George and Lynn in joke is this podcast. Alex Toth is probably more on the Never Iron Anything. It comes up regularly on the Never Iron Anything podcast. But
yeah. I am mildly addicted to Alex Toth stuff. It's a problem.
Johnny, thanks very much for giving up your time this evening for an episode that will be out towards the end of October. It's been great fun.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure. I love talking comics with you.
Absolutely. It's great talking about Frank Bellamy. And thank you to everyone for listening to Mega City Book Club. Find all of these links, including links to all of Johnny's projects, at megacitybookclub.com. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky as well, Mastodon, the 2000 AD forums. We have completely deleted the Twitter account now altogether. It was there as a placeholder for a while, but I've got rid of it altogether. And email me, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com, if you've got a book or an artist that you'd like to come on the podcast and talk about. So until next time, when we're passing judgment on another great book, it's goodbye from me and...
It's goodbye from him.